Hello and welcome to Irreverent Testimony, the political podcast from a left-wing perspective by and for millennial and Gen Xer types. It is March 9th, 2016, and we have our very special guest, our friend Will McLeod from the Hopping Mad podcast. How you doing, Will?
Doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. It's great to have you on. Rachel is here as well, of course.
Hi.
And yeah, we got a lot to talk about. We have sort of an off the just horse race politics agenda stuff to talk about, which I'm excited about. But we would be remiss not to talk about what happened in Michigan last night.
Yeah. Yeah.
So something happened in Michigan last night, I hear. What's this all about, Will?
Bernie won. Bernie won when he was supposed to lose by 20 to 30 points.
Yeah.
And everybody who's listened to our podcast with you and your podcast with me in the past knows I'm probably a Clinton supporter, but I find this incredibly exciting because, as John Oliver said, this is sports for nerds.
Yeah.
And so when the numbers don't quite line up and we get to look at those and try to see what happens, it's exciting for us. Now, of course, there's a small number of people on both sides that really hate the other person. And yes. Those people are just as insufferable when they're Clinton supporters who don't like Bernie as they are when they're Bernie supporters who think that Clinton is literally Satan and probably killed Vince Foster. Or whatever.
They're insufferable from any angle. Absolutely.
Yeah. But leaving those guys aside, the rest of us can be excited because here's the question. So this situation in Michigan where Clinton was supposed to win by 20, 30 points, what if there's a problem with the way people are doing polling, like we saw in the UK recently, where people aren't properly predicting what the electorate is going to look like? Because remember, the exit polls from Michigan also said Clinton was on the path for a victory.
Actually, most of the exits I saw showed close to how it turned out. I'm not sure which exits. The ones I saw later in the night showed Bernie with like a 1-point lead.
Huh.
So okay,
I may have mistaken the Michigan and Mississippi exit polls then.
Yeah.
I wasn't paying a lot of attention last night because I was expecting things to not really have an exciting result. So
No, me either.
I came in at like midnight about to go to bed. I'm like, what? Bernie what? And was excited and was looking at the numbers because I'd remembered a different thing. So I'm probably wrong there. But
well, yeah, a few people had called me, you know, in the afternoon saying, you excited about tonight? And I said, no, because I believed, you know, 538 and everybody else, 538 put a plus 99% chance of a Clinton win and expected the spread to be about 60-38. And 538 is really, really, really good at this.
Yeah.
They nail this more often than not. And if they are wrong, it's usually by 5 or 6 points at worst. It has never been like this before. And they were as slack-jawed as anybody else. The for a little Colorado flavor, the last big upset in terms of completely turning the polls on its head were Mondale Gary Hart back in 1984, where I think Mondale had close to a 20-point lead as far as the most recent polls, and Hart ended up winning by like 7-10, I think. So you have to go all the way back 30-plus years to get that.
Yeah, this is even bigger than Clinton's New Hampshire win against Obama.
Oh, way bigger. That was just like a 10 or 15-point swing. This is like a 25, 30-point swing.
And so, again, the interesting question is there – if there's a problem with this poll, is there a problem with the methodology for other states that look like Michigan? What are we going to see in Ohio? What are we going to see in Illinois? That's the exciting question for us here. So –
well, I got really nerdy about polling in 08 and 12 because I saw such wild fluctuations. And of course, the media just jumps on any single poll to try to categorize how the race is, which is dumb, of course. But I kind of looked into it a little more, and every different polling firm uses what they call their special sauce, their methodology, where they weight it in terms of how they anticipate the electorate is actually going to look come the election time. Nobody, virtually no one, just uses raw numbers and says, I called 100 people and 50 said Sanders and 50 said Clinton. No, they put all these metrics into it. And I wrote a blog, a long blog, about how Gallup had it completely wrong in 2012. Because if you remember, they kept showing Romney with like 7-8 point leads. consistently. And I just knew that was wrong. I mean, I didn't have to be a partisan to know it was wrong. It was flying in the face by 15 points or so of every other national poll out there, NBC, Wall Street Journal, Fox, Politico, everybody. So I looked at their methodology and I went to see if I was considered a likely voter. And on a 7-point scale that would have gotten me to a likely voter, I only scored a 4. And I'm the I'm the most politically active partisan SOB I know. So I figured this is wrong. And when I actually delved into it, it basically wiped out everybody 35 and under who hasn't been living in the same place and voting in the same place for the past 10 years, which is ridiculous, which is virtually no 35-year-old and under. So they basically wiped out a massive chunk of the voting population to decide these are going to be the likely voters. And it showed that Romney was going to win. And of course, it was wrong. And I think they still are. I think they've tweaked it a little, but not enough. So Gallup is still going to show you a lot of bad numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And the other aspect of that is they were predicting the breakdown in the 2012 presidential election
to look like 2010.
They saw 2010. Yeah, they were assuming that everybody who was upset with Obama and stayed home in 2010 was going to stay home again in 2012. The difference being that Barack Obama kept his powder dry in 2010 and wasn't going to make that same mistake in 2012. He was actually willing to fight the Republicans and actually campaign.
Well, yeah.
One of the consistent frustrations we've had with the Obama administration is that they really could have campaigned harder in those midterm elections.
It's even more structurally simple than that, I think, Will, in that generals, Democrats show up. Midterms, they don't. And Democrats and Republicans keep making this mistake, right? After the 2008 wave election, liberals thought, wow, this is a sea change and look how politically involved we are. 2010, they didn't show up and the Republicans said, ah, see, that was a flash in the pan and we're going to roll in 2012 because they're not showing up anymore and the demographics are swinging back to 1980, which is ridiculous, of course. And then 12 back and forth and back and forth we go. So this is going to be a good election for us, and then we'll be tearing our hair out in 2018 if, you know, history is any indication.
Well, that's one of the things that I would hope we can change. It's one of the things Killer Mike said, actually.
It's what we're trying to change.
What a political revolution actually is that we come out in 2 years again and we don't care about any one candidate. We care about actually changing the, you know, way things work. And if that's
exactly
if the Bernie campaign can accomplish that, then it doesn't matter who the president of the United States is going to be, because they're going to sweep out Congress over time. They're going to slowly change everything, and we're going to be able to get those sweeping changes we want. If they're actually able to sell it to Americans that one election doesn't matter, it's every election, and consistently pushing for this change always, then eventually they're going to create a Congress where the sweeping changes they want happen. And if they do this on the state level, then Do you know that you could change the Constitution in an afternoon if you wanted to? All you need is control of 37 state houses.
Yeah.
If you have control of 37 state houses, you can call a constitutional convention under Article 5 of the Constitution and immediately ratify amendments, potentially, depending on the rules of local things. But you can get close to ratification if you just control state houses and nobody respects those, and selling that to the American people and saying there's the process is difficult.
It is, especially our younger generation here. We're working on that. Rachel, you can probably speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole game, right? And that's the thing that we seem to not be able to convince younger voters of, is that all politics are local. But if you control your city council and your state house and your state legislature, and then above that, you know, the Senate and the Congress, even beyond just like the Congress, just your literal like local elections will impact your life more than who the president is, largely. And you can have greater control. You have a greater voice. Your vote matters more. Going from just contacting your local politicians upwards to federal politicians, you're much more likely to hear back from your city council person or your mayor or your state house representative, because their vote, your vote, matters to them more than, let's say, if I call Barack Obama, not likely to hear back from him, right? So
yeah,
it's vital that people get involved in local politics and at least vote in local elections.
And realize that getting involved, they can actually do something. Maybe not everything they want to do, but
change. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, the thing is, if you can control the local elections, then you control something as simple as where the resources in an election go. So you can bring down the lines in Democratic areas that are created because the city council gave a sleepy suburb 90 ballot boxes for people to use and only 10 boxes for the area where there are a ton of people. That's part of voter suppression.
Yes.
Is shifting around the equipment. And that's something that's been entirely unaddressed because the thinking in our laws is, well, if people were really that terrible, then folks would vote them out.
Not if they don't have the opportunity.
Yeah, and it's so it's stuff like that where the new equipment goes where it's not needed, and folks in areas that they're trying to suppress the turnout end up with those long lines as a result. It's situations like, which sometimes, you know, you have the situation you guys were talking about in Colorado where it just wasn't expected.
Yeah.
But where you consistently have long lines and nothing is done about that, that means those long lines are intentional.
Absolutely.
And controlling something small like that will change the outcome of an election because people got to go to work. And there are going to be people who leave the line.
Where are those long lines, right? So where there are major urban populations, where there are lots and lots of people, the demographic is likely to be much more diverse. And the more diverse the demographic is, the more likely that demographic is going to vote Democrat. And so, of course, it makes sense that we want to make it harder for diverse demographics, particularly people of color and working class people, make it harder for them to vote. They're less likely to vote. And then we are likelier to come out Republican, right?
Yeah, that's the tactic. And so if we do take over the local stuff, if you control local stuff, you can help work for state house change. And that's things like the death penalty with Virginia today, considering going back to the electric chair, because they think not having the drugs they need to kill people is worse than cooking people alive. So there's that situation going on in Virginia today. If you were able to have an effect in the Virginia state house, you'd be able to stop stuff like that. That matters. But we have a country that doesn't understand that because we haven't explained it. We haven't done our job yet as independent media to really do the work, although you guys are doing fantastic work on that front, and we're trying to in ours as well. If we can change that view and help people understand the importance of local politics. And that's why I look at something like what happened in Michigan. I'm like, well, that's exciting. I wonder where this is going, and why I think your caucus reporting is so exciting, because if you get people locked into the process and they get comfortable with the process, then they can actually change it in ways that really do matter in a very short period of time.
And to that end, for all the people complaining that these caucuses suck and they're a nightmare, they're not democratic, which there's good arguments pro and con for that, but they're not going anywhere because they're cheaper and we're likely to see more of them, not less.
Yes.
I think that, you know, there's going to be some calls between secretaries of state, maybe somebody who had a primary and they're looking at their bill and they're hearing complaints from a place like Colorado, but they're going to call up and say, hey, how much does that caucus cost you? And then all of a sudden, I think you're going to see more caucuses, not less. That's just my guess, my opinion.
Yeah.
In the age of state cost cutting.
Yeah, that's true. And then that means what we need to do is make sure that the caucuses are open and available to people who can't caucus.
Right. There's advantages for us, like we said, for the young people to get involved, for people of color to get involved, for people to, you know, it's an opportunity. With all of its inherent problems, granted, there's a real opportunity to make some change within the caucus process. So we need to use it to our advantage.
Yeah, that's true.
Agreed.
So before we pivot off the Bernie thing, I am excited, but I'm still realistic. And the realism of last night is the story is Michigan because it was such a big upset, but it was such a crushing in Louisiana that when you added up all the delegates, Hillary still netted more delegates for the night last night to add to her lead. And that is getting lost on the back page, that very important part of the story of last night. So when you look at it, did Bernie gain ground in the conversation? Yes. In the delegate math? No. So what it means, and this is getting back to what you asked, Will, for this to make a real difference, then these contests coming up the 15th, the polling has to be just as wrong as it was in Michigan as well.
Yeah. And to add to that, I would say that he did lose ground, but he lost less ground than he was expected to lose. Right. So you're going from losing less ground eventually. And people say that's going to be March 15th. Eventually, there's going to be a point of no return where there just isn't the math for him to recover with blowout victories. But if he can turn losing less ground into actually gaining ground in a positive direction, there's still a possibility for a Bernie win. And, you know, I am not going to disparage his chances, even though it is important to be realistic about that. And either way, if he has the money to stay in the race right up until the convention and actually make arguments and encourage people to become a part of politics and actually makes it feel, for me here in D.C., who is the last person to get a cast of primary vote, that I actually get to be a part of this process for once, I think that's a great thing. If Bernie wants to stay into the convention, let him.
Oh, he's going to no matter what. He's going to stay into the convention come hell or high water. There's no question about that. Yeah. And he should.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying as someone who's a Clinton supporter, is there are people who are like, well, Bernie should drop out of the race and get out of
The longer he's in, the more delegates he has, the more people like us he gets involved in the caucus states that are still coming up.
There is structural good happening to the Democratic Party right now if he loses. Mm-hmm. He's already changed the Democratic conversation. He's already done things I think are fantastic, and I am glad he's a part of the process.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, anyway, but we can pivot away from that now if you guys are ready.
Yeah, I believe so. Rachel, anything to add to the big win for Bernie last night?
No, I'm really excited by it. Like you guys were saying, I don't think ultimately it changes the fact that Clinton will likely clinch the nomination, but I want him in as long as possible. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. So moving forward, we're going to touch on something that has been scarcely talked about on either side of the aisle in this presidential campaign. Which is very weird to me because it was such a hot button issue and it still is, and nobody's talking about it essentially, except for the candidates bringing up themselves. I rarely any moderator is, and that is some LGBT issues, rights, legislation, and I'm kind of going to turn this over a little bit to Rachel and Will at this point.
Sure. So one of the things I think is important to note is that I think for the majority of the American population that does not identify as LGBT or allies, we got marriage equality, right? So once we had marriage equality, then the fight's over. We're done. Yeah. And I think for members of the LGBT community, of which I am one, as is Will, we don't see it that way at all. And there's a lot more to be done. And I would just like to, I think we're sort of taking this opportunity to say, here are some of the issues that we still are facing. Here are some of the stats that we're still looking at. And here are some of the things that we should be addressing. And I would like to see it be addressed by the presidential candidates. But if they're not going to, then we are. So there's a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with marriage, that marriage did not solve, that the LGBT community still faces.
Absolutely there are. And I think that the rhetoric that's being used, that is the statement I like, is people are getting married on Saturday and fired on Monday.
Yeah,
exactly.
We have marriage equality, but we don't have legal protection in our anti-discrimination laws.
Correct.
We have a situation where they're going after our trans allies who are children about whether or not they're allowed to use the appropriate bathroom.
Yes. Please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have that situation where. And it goes back to this continued slur against trans people, that there's some kind of fetishist that is doing this to get some kind of thrill rather than the fact that they are someone who they're not the gender that they were assigned at birth is the issue.
Correct.
That's the issue, is that they do not identify with and do not feel comfortable with the gender that they have been assigned. And so they go to the gender that they feel to be their natural gender. And that is something which we understand on a psychological level, which we understand as something real, is being turned into this slur that these folks are getting some kind of sexual thrill. Even 7-year-olds who are coming out as trans, who have not matured sexually, are somehow supposed to be awful, perverted predators, according to the people attacking them and trying to ban them from bathrooms.
Right. And this notion that trans women are rapists, essentially, right? That we should not allow trans women into women's restrooms because they're going to rape women in restrooms. Let me tell you the statistics on that. Zero times has that ever been reported. What I can tell you is that men, cisgendered men, have broken into women's bathrooms and raped women, but they sure didn't need to, quote, dress like a woman or, you know, try to pass as trans to do that. They just busted into a bathroom and raped a woman. The number of times a trans woman has raped a woman in a bathroom, a cisgendered woman or any other person in that bathroom, is zero times.
Right? Zero times. Yeah.
Zero times.
And that's the thing, is if you do have someone who wants to invade a bathroom and rape someone, they're not going to do it by dressing up in a dress.
No, or going through hormone therapy or
all of the other massive steps,
surgery or anything else.
They're going to break down the door. That's how that happens. So we know this is an awful. And you know what else we know? Trans women are one of the largest groups of people to experience sexual assault in the country.
So I have some statistics about that, actually.
Go ahead.
50% of trans women have reported being raped or assaulted by a romantic partner.
50%.
50%. Trans women have a 1 in 12 chance of being murdered. Trans women of color have a 1 in 8 chance of being murdered in their lifetime. So the violence perpetrated is not by trans women, but on trans women.
And that is what people are, they're taking a situation where folks are getting murdered, where you hear about these murders all the time. Well, if you're those of us who are in the LGBT community, we hear about them. We hear about trans issues all the time. But what you don't hear is you don't hear from politicians or from people in the media or in the, well, I should say, traditional media, that the people who are more likely to get attacked are the trans women themselves. You hear this awful slur that trans women are going to attack people, which we know from the numbers has never happened.
Correct.
And then you have a media that refuses to knock that down, even though it's blatantly false, bigoted, and encourages the kind of violence against trans people that we see.
That's exactly a good point, too, Will, is that the rhetoric around this bathroom issue is not doing anything but perpetrating this idea that these people are perversions of something and that they are... It's really dehumanizing.
Well, it gets ratings, right? Don't the local news anchors love to say, you know, are cross-dressers going to come up to your kid in the bathroom? And right. So that's why
it's
it gets play.
But it really dehumanizes these people and I think contributes to the violence that they experience.
That's absolutely true. That's simply the fact that this is a method of othering. This kind of language, it's designed to turn trans people into an acceptable target for murder or attack. Right. We see exactly the same kind of language being used in Nazi Germany about groups they thought were undesirable. Right. The right wing, who's attacking trans people right now, is using that kind of language on trans people.
Yeah.
And the other group of people that is kind of ignored is trans men.
Yes.
We don't ever talk about trans men.
Yes. And they're not Caitlyn Jenner, right? They're not really in the media. They're not really a thing that's talked about. And so, you know, I wonder sometimes if the general understanding of trans issues in this country really erases trans men in a way that people don't realize they exist.
It does. It does. Trans men, and they exist within that same spectrum of erasure that, you know, you and I do as bisexuals.
Yes.
Where, and to talk about that concept. So I am married to a woman.
Yes.
People automatically assume when they meet me because of that, that I am straight.
Correct. I'm married to a man. People automatically assume when they meet me that I'm straight.
I have friends who are bisexuals who have either married where they've been allowed to or are planning on marrying now that it is allowed. People of the same gender expression, the same sex. And as a result, they're assumed that they are either gay or lesbian.
Yes, correct.
The assumption of their identity, it erases them from the equation. Correct. When it comes to trans men, the way they are treated is they're treated like, oh, you're just a particularly butch lesbian.
Right.
That is how people refer to them.
Right.
Rather than accepting that they're male. Or, you know, they're like, well, we're not really talking about you because you were different. It's the there's this focus on trans women that is weird. Yes. And it happens within the left wing and within feminism. And it's just trans men are genuinely ignored and their issues are genuinely ignored and their existence is genuinely ignored.
Right.
By everyone who talks about these issues, to the point that it's hard to find statistics on trans men.
Right.
Because no one even bothers to study trans men or what they go through.
You know, I think that this comes back to, you know, when we talk about LGBT issues and how sort of far we've come with the marriage question and all of that, and how quickly it happened and how much it's become sort of part of the cultural lexicon. And I think we have to go back to why that is. And that is because it was made so visible and so public by often wealthy, cisgendered, white, gay and lesbian people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and a lot of it too was that, you know, everybody found out that they knew somebody that was gay, right?
Yeah.
But when people, when the general culture, I think, looks at LGBT, they look at LG and they forget about the BT in
yeah.
the open, right? And so in some ways, it's really good that we were able to put a face on the marriage issue that was able to be palatable to the American people in a way that gained marriage equality. But in another way, I think it has sort of done this erasure thing to people of color, to trans people, to bi people, to people that don't look like, you know, the defendants in the case sort of up against the Supreme Court. So there's an issue within the LGBT community that we talk about and we don't talk about enough, I think, which is the erasure of everybody who's not cisgendered, middle class, white, even on television, right? All the gay people on television, middle yeah. class, upper middle class, white, and gay or lesbian, never bi, never trans.
It's
right?
the Will and Grace or Ellen exactly. show version of what Americans consider a
modern
a,
family,
a gay American looks like.
Yep, the Glee, the Modern Family, the all that stuff.
Right,
right, yeah.
Because that's what those show producers have considered as palatable.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
No, that's absolutely true, and one of the consistent problems that we run into is that when they talk about, when people talk about LGBT stuff, you're right, that what they mean is LG. They ignore the B and the T. And with us who are bisexual, a lot of that comes in not just erasure, but denying that we genuinely exist at all.
Yeah.
Or when they do accept that we exist, they believe all sorts of weird things about us. For example, if I express to someone that I'm bisexual, people assume that I'm non-monogamous. Now, let me say, some people who are bisexual aren't monogamous, and that's fine. But you shouldn't make a sort of assumption about someone's love life based on who they happen to be.
Right. Sort of the example I always use is like, so for people who are straight, let's say, and mm-hmm. they're attracted to, let's say, straight men, they're attracted to women, and they're married. You don't assume that they are non-monogamous because they're attracted to other women, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing with bisexual people. You can be attracted to men and women and still be married and still maintain a monogamous commitment. You can also be attracted to men and women and not maintain monogamous commitments. But we don't assume that straight people maintain non-monogamous commitments. You know what I mean?
Even though the numbers say that the majority of people in non-monogamous relationships are in fact straight.
Straight people, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. They make up the biggest bet. It's also like you wouldn't assume that because 50 Shades of Grey is popular that everybody who's straight is into kink. That
right.
is not something you would assume.
Right.
But that's what they do. That's the assumption made. And so, and it's like, it's exactly what you said. Straight folks are not running around with other people because it's common for straight folks to do that. I'm sorry, I'm rambling now, but the assumption that's made.
Just because you're attracted to someone else doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to act on that attraction. That's no matter what your sexual orientation may be. The other thing I think that's interesting about being a bisexual is the sort of erasure from both communities.
Yes.
If you're bi and you're dating members of the opposite sex, there's this sort of anxiety around, well, are you going to leave me for a woman? Or are you going to leave me for a man? Or are you really straight? Are you really into me? And then on the other side, if you're dating someone of the same sex, there's the same anxiety. Are you really gay? Are you really into women? Are you really into men? Like, are you going to leave me for the straight lifestyle? So you're sort of not gay enough or not straight enough for many folks.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. But to go back to what Will was talking about, that's the whole licentiousness argument that the other side uses to demonize the LGBTQ community, in that making people think, straight people think, or people just don't know anybody who is LGBT, that it's all about sex, right?
Yeah.
And then so they want to describe all the really, you know, graphic sexual things that LGBT people might do. And of course, if you stop and think about it, it's the same thing that straight people do. It's just they try to play on the gross out factor. And it's funny, there was a book that came out in the early 80s and it spread like wildfire through the evangelical community. And it was like just really graphic thing about all the horrible things that gay people do. And, you know, it just talked about things like oral sex, and some gay people do things regarding anal sex. And it's like, well, straight people do all this too. I mean, what is like what is the shock and scare factor here that you're trying to get through to people who engage in the exact same things? But that's part of the trick, isn't it? It's just like, it's all about sex. They're all perverts, and yes, you know, they're having sex with everybody, and they want to have sex with you and your wife and your neighbor and your, yes, dog and the kids. And
so they're going to convert you, and they're going to convert your children.
And we're all going to throw you in a giant bisexual sex orgy. And then they bring in sneakily, like Rick Santorum and his ilk, bring in, well, if we're going to do that, why not have man on dog? And it's, yeah, you know, it, yep, and these are the people that are bringing up bestiality. You know, nobody, right, within the gay community is like, you know, I support my right to marry in the same sex or to marry a dog. It's like, no, that's what Rick Santorum is saying.
And it's a way of dehumanizing us.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
That we are animals.
And it's identical.
Describing sex acts that we may take part in or not is a way of objectifying and dehumanizing us such that it makes it so much easier to discriminate.
Absolutely. And that's exactly, it's the same sort of nonsense they believe about us is exactly the same slur that they use against trans women when they try to use the bathroom of their assigned gender, or trans men when they try to use the bathroom of their, not assigned, but their actual gender. Right. It's the same slur. It's the same dehumanizing slur, just repackaged for a group of people that's slightly different.
Yes.
And that's yep, that's what's actually happening here.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't see that this is the same slur that has existed for the past 200 some odd years since we've been talking about this stuff.
Right. Right. Okay. So the other thing, I want to go through a couple of the issues that we're dealing with still. One of them, though, what I really want to talk about is youth homelessness among the LGBT community.
Yeah.
So this is something that isn't often talked about outside of our community, but is something I think people should really be aware of and think about. So 40% of the youth in this country that are homeless identify as LGBT. When you think about how LGBT people make up between 5 and 7% of the population, the fact that 40% of homeless youth identify as LGBT is staggering. 68% of those report being kicked out of their homes by their families because of their sexuality and gender expression. So the majority of these kids are leaving homes of conflict or are being kicked out of their homes because of their gender expression or sexual orientation. And 54% report abuse by their family. So this is a serious issue. And it comes back again to dehumanizing LGBT people, right? So these parents, it's not because they don't love their children or they're monsters, but the rhetoric that we use around sexuality and gender expression in this country, particularly in the Bible Belt and particularly with religion, make it acceptable for parents, or make parents feel that they need to reject their children because they're doing something fundamentally wrong. Right.
Yeah. Here's a question. Is anybody proposed any sort of legislation to that end? I know that would be such an uphill climb. It'd be very sticky when you're talking about laws applying to family dynamics, but it would certainly put the issue on the radar.
Well, for me, so no, as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been any legislation, and I'm not sure how we would do that other than
I actually fund. I have an idea about that. And what you should do in a situation like that is if a family does, you know, disown their child or kick their child out, there should be a immediate support network available for them so that they can get an apartment, so that they can feed themselves, and so they can get to school.
Right.
That's, you know, right. if they are kicked out, they should be able to have a social worker help them get into a situation where they can take care of themselves
and be emancipated so they can be adults.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what needs to happen immediately. In fact, kicking your child out of your home should be an immediate forfeiture of custody.
Yes.
Legally. Right. Like if you've kicked this child out, then you no longer have any legal
parental rights. Yep.
Yeah.
Totally agree. So here's the other staggering statistic is that the criminalization of these youth is a really big problem.
Oh, yeah.
So even though, again, 5 to 7% of the youth population identify as LGBT, they represent 13 to 15% of juveniles in the criminal justice system. 60% of those are Black or Latino, of course. So it's disproportionately affecting LGBT youth, but it's also disproportionately affecting LGBT youth of color. 39% of homeless kids that identify as LGBT have interacted with the criminal justice system in some way. Now, part of that is survival, right? Part of it is drug sales, theft, and survival prostitution. Those are the three main things. The other thing, though, is lesser crimes that you wouldn't necessarily think of, which are things like youth curfews and sleeping in public spaces. So, yep. You know, the curfew for anyone under 18, you have to be not out at night past 10 o'clock. Well, you don't have a home to go to. And so the cops come and razzle you, and then you interact with the criminal justice system. The other thing is if you have nowhere to sleep, you're going to sleep outside. And in somewhere like, for example, Denver, where we live, we have something that is called, they passed this unbelievably absurd law about, what did they call it? City camping or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah. And yesterday they just dismantled that some of the encampments that were up around, I think, food banks, right?
And in Boulder, yeah.
Yeah.
So not only are these kids marginalized, bullied at school, kicked out of their homes, but now they're being criminalized for just existing, essentially. So it's a real problem, I think, in the community, and something that we should address more robustly in the LGBT community and hopefully outside of it.
Well, and the only way that we do address it is occasionally acknowledging that it exists. I remember being in the community in New York City, and there were these, you know, young, usually white 18-year-old, 19-year-old kids, or kids who would say they were 18 or 19-year-olds, who would just show up in the community, go to a couple of events, and then vanish.
Yeah.
And never be seen again, and we don't know who they are, where they come from, where they went. You have this population, this group of folks who's transient. We don't know what's happening to them. We don't know if they're being taken advantage of by somebody. We don't know if they're being victimized. We don't know if they are alive a couple of weeks after we first meet them. We see this in our urban centers all the time. Yeah. And we also see young LGBT folks of color being barred entry to a lot of parts of our communities. There's a lot of racism within the community that we have not developed. Like, nobody even remembers.
I like to talk about, but it's very true.
Nobody even remembers Bayard Rustin's name.
Yeah.
And that's he marched with King, and he's one of the major LGBT leaders of the 20th century, and nobody remembers his name.
Right. That movie that came out, Stonewall, which I haven't watched because precisely this reason, they completely whitewashed it.
Oh, yeah. Right. It's all white people. There are no trans women there.
The trans women of color that really started the whole thing in the first fucking place. They're not even in the movie. It's infuriating.
And that's one of the things is it was not your white, cisgendered, easy to look at people who started the Stonewall riots. Nope. It was trans women of color who threw the first stones, and everybody's else like, nope, we're not letting them get beat up by themselves. We're doing this now.
Right. Exactly.
They sparked it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And they were completely whitewashed from the, you know, it's a Hollywood movie, so I guess you got to have that. But, I mean, it's completely changed the history of what happened, and it's infuriating to me, which is why I haven't watched it.
Well, when it comes to LGBT history, we don't learn it. We don't teach it in schools. Exactly. You have to learn this stuff for yourself. And so if you're in a position in the community where you are learning your history for yourself, where you're learning about Stonewall, where you have never heard of Bayard Rustin, for example, and you have to like look him up on Wikipedia because nobody's going to tell you, and you come across a movie like Stonewall, you're gonna accept the whitewashed version of what happened, because this is your only access to your history is this kind of, you know, cultural history rather than actual history. That is a problem we have.
It is. It is. Absolutely. I completely agree. I completely agree. And, you know, going back to how people of color are more disproportionately affected, right? Intersectionality, looking at race and violence in this community, 87% of LGBTQH, and the H in this one stands for HIV positive, murders in 2011 were people of color.
Yep.
So 87% of LGBT murders were people of color. In 2012, 45% of all murders that were labeled as hate crimes were against trans women.
Who represent, I think, one of the smallest percentages, by the way, of the LGBT community. Yeah. Trans people are a minority of a minority.
Exactly.
And so when a minority of a minority makes represents 45% of the murders.
Yeah, that were labeled as hate crimes. I mean, that's staggering.
Yeah.
Right? That's staggering. Yeah. I mean, 87%. So people of color who are LGBTQH. Mm-hmm. That were murdered were people of color. That's, again, it's a minority within a minority that makes up the majority. It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's a serious thing that we are not talking about, that we have to start talking about, period.
Absolutely. And I think also we as bisexuals need to, there's a kind of self-erasure that goes on where for a lot of us, it feels like maybe we shouldn't have a place in the community because all we see are, you know, lesbians and gays. All we see are our other allies, you know, having these positions front and center. And even though we are the largest group of LGBT folks, we've also become the quietest.
Yes. And, you know, we get accused a lot of doing that on purpose, right? We don't come out. And so we sort of retain straight privilege. Yeah. I'm able to walk around in the world with straight privilege because I walk around with men. That's true. And that's something that we have to own. And I think more of us have to come the fuck out already, first of all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And stop retaining that straight privilege. And that's a fair criticism of the bisexual community. But we also do need to feel like we're a part of the community. We need to engage the community. And we need to sort of, if for nothing else, like things like health, right? There's a lot of statistics about the different and increased health risks of LGBT people, bisexuals in particular, that doctors don't know how to address, don't ask about, and that we feel sort of judged by talking about. Precisely going back to what you were saying, if I tell my doctor I'm bisexual, this onslaught of questions comes about my sex life and, you know, sort of a sense of judgment, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think for bisexuals, it's those are the two things. Like, come out, first of all. Don't retain your straight privilege, and then engage in the community. It's important.
And the other aspect of that is you know, we do need to ourselves take the initiative to be a part of the community, because you get out of the community what you put into it. But the other thing is, as we're moving into these spaces, we need to bring our fellow erased people along with us. We need to have the back of people of color within the community. We need to have the back of trans people, because obviously the current folks running things aren't doing a very good job there. Yep. We need to make sure that we not only have a positive effect for us, but everybody else who is ignored. And as the largest group of any LGBT group, we have the numbers to be able to have that positive effect. It's time for us to have it.
I agree. I completely agree. So all you bisexuals out there, hear us. And get involved.
This is a very American perspective as well. I hear there are so many bisexual folks I know in the UK who refuse to come out as bisexual because of the level of bigotry they're afraid of getting.
Right.
Because there's an enhanced hatred that they feel in the UK of being, I don't know, some kind of wishy-washy half whatever.
Yeah, that's especially true outside of London and as you travel north.
I've found. So there's, as I'm trying to talk to, you know, with my UK stuff, more LGBT folks in the UK, I'm finding that as we have different cultures and different cultural constructs, the lines are different. We always talk about how race as an entity is a social construct, and I found that it is, and that means that the lines are in different places as you change from society to society.
Right.
You have completely different varieties of racism and racial constructs in the UK, where people do consider English to be a race, and Scottish and Welsh to be set, and there is some level of stuff that we can't get into because it's so incredibly complicated there. But that also means that the constructs around gender and LGBT stuff are also different. So they're in it's the same kind of slurs that are used, but they're used in different ways. So there's, especially in a country that has, you know, lower levels of church attendance and yet equally high levels of homophobia and equally high levels of bigotry against LGBT folks.
Oh, no. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to Christianity. That's certainly an American facet where you have a lot of evangelicals who are very militantly anti-gay. But it's, you know, there's plenty of secular places throughout history, modern and past, that are just as hostile to LGBT people.
I don't know that much about the UK, and I've never been, but both of you do and have. I feel like there's at least a perception that I have that it's sort of a machismo culture over there, that there's some sort of masculinity that is a little bit expressed differently. This year, is that part of, because I think homophobia really is a version of sexism, right? Particularly.
I'll let Will answer that first.
There are four countries that are part of the UK, each with an independent culture. And within those four countries, you have various groups and subcultures, and you have various even smaller cultural groups and ethnic minorities. And so it's nowhere near as cohesive as the United States, even though the United States is a lot bigger and you would think would have a lot more groups of people. So masculinity has varying kinds of expression in varying cultures. And so sexism as an entity is even harder for British feminists to tackle because, you do have, you know, English lad culture. And then in Scotland, you have another sort of working class male culture that is completely different and does have sexist issues there, but the issues are different. And the way to deal with it then has to be different because you have to address the specific problems. And I'm assuming the same thing is true of Wales, even though I've never been to Wales. I've just had talks with folks who are from Wales and Welsh LGBT folks. So as we look at this entity that is the UK, it's so incredibly complicated. And the folks who are on the ground really do understand the best ways to deal with it.
Yeah.
There was one British feminist who I've had a lot of conversations with, and I find a lot of times I will think maybe I disagree with this person, and the only difference is the language we're using to discuss a specific problem, or there being a very specific problem unique to her location that I would never have considered because it's not something I've seen before. Wow. So understanding, and that's, again, we are dealing, when we are talking about intersectionality, we're dealing with social constructs. And when you change society, the constructs are different. And thus the issues change. That doesn't mean that there's not sexism or racism, but that there's a different entity you're dealing with.
Right.
And some of the things are going to be identical and some of them are going to be different.
Right. I think, you know, Dan Savage has a line that he likes to talk about, which is to say that homophobia, specifically homophobia against gay men, which seems to be where most of it sort of lands in the general culture, is a version of sexism, right?
Yeah.
That these people don't like gay men because they're like women, right?
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of tackle that form of homophobia the same kind of way that you tackle sexism, that the two are very much interlinked.
Well, just to interrupt, since we're talking about sexism, there's some sort of breaking news from the pop culture world. I know that Rachel has a little bit, Will. I don't know if you've been following the whole Kesha/Sony Records/Dr. Mm-hmm. Luke controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, amid a public outcry, Sony has dropped Dr. Luke.
Wow.
So she won.
That's fantastic.
And for full disclosure, we're not Kesha fans in the slightest, but we are definitely fans of protecting victims or even alleged victims to get due process of sexual assault.
We believe women, first of all.
Can I come in and say, yeah. I'm not sure how much of a victory that is, because this organization that has treated her so poorly still owns her contract now.
You're absolutely right.
She won't have to work with a sexual abuser, but she'll still have to work with the people who tried to make her do that.
Well, having been in the music business for way too long, that I'm 1,000% with you, and I kind of hate major labels in general, but it is a victory in the sense that there was enough of an outcry mobilized for a victim of sexual assault that it actually got a huge, titanic, massive company to make a decision based on the outcry of people. So in that sense, I say it is a victory.
I do too. I'll claim it as one only because of exactly that. And just on a personal level for her, not having to either make the choice essentially of don't make music, don't have a livelihood anymore, or go to work every day and work with your rapist. So from that perspective, that's good. Sony can eat a dick. I mean, they're assholes, obviously, but that's good news.
A bag of dicks. They can eat an entire bag of dicks.
An entire bag of dicks.
And I still have my framed picture of my rejection letter from Sony Records and Clive Davis himself. So,
right.
It wasn't a great album. I don't actually blame them for that. But no, the point is, you know, at first, until the public outcry, yeah, you're right. Sony was saying, no, you can't get out of this contract. He's the best producer. I don't care if he raped you. Essentially is what they said. And to make it even worse, the judge wouldn't even put an injunction until they could, you know, investigate the claims. They said, no, you're under contract, so you got to work with him, which was a horrible PR for her. And she kind of ruined her career with that, the judge in that case in New York. And now Sony faced enough public outcry that they had to make that move.
Many survivors that came out, and not even just survivors, but just people who were so upset, and then other people in the music industry, and there was so much outcry about, you know, we complain constantly about the underreporting of rape and sexual assault, and why do we think it's so underreported? And you look at this case of someone who has a lot of money and a lot of privilege and a lot of sort of power in her own sort of way, and she's treated like this in the criminal justice system. What chance does someone who doesn't have any of that?
Well, sure. And even if you look at the Cosby case, a lot of these women were.
Why would they come forward? Why?
Right. They had.
It's not against a famous person. It's right, just against.
Well, he was more famous. I'm saying, like, they already had, you know, they were models or actresses or had, you know, some degree of clout on their own right. But, you know.
Exactly. And so the average woman, maybe who's even more disadvantaged, let's say they're LGBTQ, or let's say they're a person of color, or they're, you know, in poverty, or a number of other things, a sex worker, right? Yeah. What are the chances that these people are going to come forward when you look at something like this and how terribly this sort of famous white girl was treated?
Well, what have we seen in the last few months? The Cosby facade is completely fallen, and he may actually, yes, decades way too late, but he may actually face the music to some degree now. Mm-hmm. And we see this action now with this Uncle Luke guy in Kesha. So it's progress. It's not perfect by any means, but maybe there's actually some progress. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back when we're talking some closing thoughts on this. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Like Mick Jagger. I'm talking about everybody getting crunk, crunk. Boys try to touch my junk, junk. Gonna smack him if he getting too drunk, drunk. Nah, nah, we go until they kick us out, out of the police. Shut us down, down. Police shut us down, down. Po-po shut us down. Don't stop, make it pop. DJ blow my speakers up tonight. I'ma fight till we see the
Hello and welcome back to Irreverent Testimony. Rachel and I are here. We have our good friend Will McLeod from the Hopping Mad podcast, and we're talking about LGBTQ rights and issues. And we can talk a little bit more about some of the issues that you guys brought up, some really great stuff. But I kind of wanted to get a sense of what you guys think or where it should go, since it's not being talked about with the presidential candidates really much at all. I can understand why they're avoiding it like the plague on the Republican side, because the public sentiment has gone in the right direction so dramatically and quickly in the last few years that they don't want to be seen as anti-gay. They know it'll hurt them in a general election, but it's going to have to come up sometime. But it's not even really being brought up much. I know Bernie and Hillary are individually bringing it up on their own. They're hardly ever being prompted. I think in any debate, it may have come up once from a moderator, and it's not the only thing. I mean, climate change might as well not be a thing because nobody's bringing that up either. But what are your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, if I could just say, you know, we are a wedge issue in the South now in the other direction. If you look at the way that demographics have gone for us in the South, there are now more people who believe in our rights than people who want us to not exist. Right. And so if you actually made us an issue, Democratic Party, you would force the Republicans to make stupid decisions about trying to take our rights away, which would then get a bunch of people rolling into the polls to vote against it.
Well, is that
we are an issue that if you talk about our issues, we will be helpful to you. And even though I don't expect you to do anything right now, at least talking about the issues that affect us would be positive for you in an election and maybe get us the attention we need to handle what we've talked about on the show, which is the attacks on trans women, the issues affecting people of color who are LGBT, the issues with homelessness among our youth. These are things that can be done about if we just pay attention to the problems. But you're not even willing to pay attention to the problems. That's the issue. Just pay some attention to us and our needs, and things can start moving in a positive direction.
And exactly to that point, and sort of what we were talking about on Hopping Mad the other day about reproductive rights, which is what you were sort of saying. Like, I get the Democrats, Hillary and Bernie, are for us. I hear Hillary mention us often, just sort of as a, you know, part of her stump speech as a caveat.
Yeah.
But if they start talking about, hey, here's where we agree, once they start talking about it, it forces the hand of the Republicans to talk about it. And the more they open their mouths, because they can't say, oh, yeah, I'm for marriage equality, and yeah, we got to do something about those homeless kids. They're not going to say that, right? They can't and win a primary in the Republican Party. So the more we talk about it, the more they're forced to talk about it. And when they open their mouths, the public sentiment is not on their side. So we gain ground. They look like assholes. And that's the best possible answer.
Absolutely.
Politically, and as far as what I want them to do, I would really like them to address some of the stuff we talked about today. You know, health issues, violence, homelessness. These are things that could be very easily dealt with for probably not a whole lot of money that would make significant impact in our community.
Yeah. You know, handling this problem for LGBT youth would be a lot cheaper than sending them to jail and having them involved in the criminal justice system. Right. We're not talking about a large group of people.
Nope.
We were talking about a very small number of people. So fixing this problem would probably save your government's money.
Yes.
So do it, please.
Yes.
It's
not to mention just the moral implication of it. Let's not let an already marginalized group of children be further marginalized and victimized. It's a moral issue.
It is a moral issue. I would love for people to be able to see that, but unfortunately, the arguments that work aren't, well, maybe people should stop killing us. It's, hey, we can save you money off of your budget you're trying to balance.
Yep.
And so that's,
are we worried that the lack of talk about this, at least on the Democratic side, has been the party's insistence still to play to this middle that doesn't really exist anymore? Because the few times it is brought up to Hillary Clinton, she doesn't seem to be shying away from it.
No, and the thing is, she's brought it up herself. She's the one who has a quote, people are getting married on Saturday and fired on Monday. One day, we got to fix that. Yes. She's the one bringing this stuff up. This isn't her running to the middle, and Bernie brings it up when he can, too. This is not, our candidates are not shying away from this. The media isn't asking questions. Party leadership doesn't seem to be interested. And there's no movement from groups that we normally expect to be our allies. Our candidates are giving great answers to questions when they're asked and are bringing it up when they're not.
And this goes back to the original point of, you know, people think the gay issue is solved now because we have marriage equality. I don't even know that the media is aware, or some of the party leadership, or anyone really that's not in our community is aware of all of the massive things that are still happening that we still need to address. I think it's really about educating the public, educating the media, and getting them to ask the questions. Because you're right, when the rare question is asked, they both have great answers.
Yeah. And so it's not like we feel like our candidates are ignoring them. It's everybody else. Nobody seems to understand that we still have some pretty big problems in our community that are caused in large cases by the bigotry of other people.
Yes.
You mean Americans care about more than ISIS and taxes? Because that's all right. I thought that's it. That's all that there is in America is ISIS and taxes.
Yep, ISIS and taxes.
Right.
The two things that are inevitable in life, ISIS and taxes, according
to
pundits.
One or both of the candidates pivot when we're talking about healthcare and pivot from, you know, Obamacare is great or he's going to burn it down or whatever, and pivot to this is a great way to get into LGBT issues, right? Talk about the number of the disparaging between 82% of straight people have health insurance, only 77% of LGBT people have health insurance, and like 57% of trans people have health insurance.
And in most cases, trans people don't have HRT covered, so they don't have hormone replacement therapy. So if you're a trans person whose main existential threat to your life is suicide because you can't properly transition and your medical insurance doesn't cover transitioning, how can you say that person actually has health insurance at that point when the major existential threat to their life is not covered? It's called cosmetic.
Right. Exactly correct. So I have an interesting personal story about this. I know a trans woman who is dating a emergency room doctor. And he found out that she was getting her hormone replacement therapy from Mexico. And he was horrified by that and said, well, no, don't do that. And I'll prescribe it to you. And why are you doing this? Why? And she told him the story, basically, that in Denver, the only way that you can get HRT is to go to the clinic, which is like the low income free clinic in Denver. You're going to have massive wait times. You're going to have, you know, you sit there for 6 hours and maybe you get to see someone who's not particularly qualified but has to help you. And so what she did was she and her boyfriend opened up a facility in Denver. She's a hairstylist, and so she does hair and makeup and that kind of stuff. And he opened up a medical facility specifically to provide hormone replacement therapy for trans people. He also does a bunch of other medical aesthetic stuff like laser hair removal and that kind of stuff. But their primary bread and butter is HRT. And that's because they're the only place in Denver that you can do that. There's one other place way out in the South Burbs, almost to Colorado Springs. There's a doctor who does it. But again, that's a 2-hour drive and there's about a 6-month wait. So it's not even just about coverage, it's also about access and having doctors that understand at all what your needs are, what the dosage should be, and then also the issue of, people going and getting it black market and maybe not taking the right dose and having adverse health effects from that. So there's a lot of issues around the trans health problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is something that we would like our politicians to talk about or recognize. And when we're talking about healthcare, recognizing that if someone is trans and does not have transition covered, then they don't have healthcare.
Yes, correct.
Just full stop. They don't have healthcare.
Yeah. And if they are covered, if they did have HRT covered, where do they go? Is there a place? Can they get it? Do they have to drive for 6 hours? Do they have to be wealthy and travel? I mean, yeah.
And that comes back to the LGBT people of color, who by and large in their own community and in our community don't have a lot of respect. So they're more likely to be impoverished than any other group within the LGBT community. And as a result, they're not going to have the resources to get to transition if they need it.
Yep.
And that's all this stuff is intersecting in a way that we are not dealing with properly. Yes. And we would like maybe someone to talk about the fact that if transgender folks do not have HRT covered, or a mandate for that, or some kind of, maybe we should be pushing for a return of the Equal Rights Amendment, but one that is not just LGBT inclusive, but trans inclusive as well.
Yes. Completely agree.
Maybe that should be our thing. You know, let's have the ERA. You defeated it last time, so it's going to be women and LGBT folks.
Here's the issue, guys, and I think you're kind of touching on it, if not directly, then indirectly. I think that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party are more than happy to go down the road of full-throated endorsement of gay marriage, gay rights. Trans is a different beast, though. And I think they feel like a big part of their voting block, and this is probably true, is still a little squeamish about trans. And so I think that how do they parse this out going forward? And are we actually going to see this talked about in a real debate until we get to a general election? And how would candidate Trump handle that?
That makes me think it's the perfect time to talk about it.
Sure.
Because Trump is going to say something against trans people that is so disgusting and so bigoted that even rational folks who aren't really sure about – that most rational folks who aren't sure about trans stuff, who are kind of conservative, are going to say that's too far. He's talked about killing large groups of people.
Yeah.
There's no reason why he wouldn't say something that the Republican Party would otherwise he not say. This is the time to bring this stuff up. This is the time to open the door so that when Trump walks through it, he says a bunch of awful stuff that draw a distinction between that kind of bigotry and the reality that people are living.
Yeah, Citizen Trump has been okay on gay stuff, but on gay issues, but now this new candidate Trump, who's appealing to a certain segment of the population, I have to believe is going to be pretty hostile to gay marriage and, just like you said, just disgusting and awful in terms of trans rights.
Yes.
I mean, I can't imagine it going any other way. Oh. I know once he gets the nomination sewed up, he is going to try to pivot back to the middle just like every other candidate. But on this stuff, I don't think so.
Well, and that's the other thing is if there we enter his place and he's not the horrible person that we assume he's going to be, then we have another argument, which is, look, even Donald Trump, noted neo-fascist, is fine with trans folks having access to the medicine they do. He won't be.
No.
But maybe if he is, either way, it's a win-win. This is the time to talk about it.
Yes.
I agree with you, 1,000%. You got to strike while the iron is hot. And I think there's still a lot of Democratic establishment out there that's a little sketchy about it. It's just, we don't want to go too far. We need this coalition of these blue dog Democrats or whatever the hell, they want to call it, the blue collar folks. And
well, hold on. Most of those folks are, if we can say, African-American. They're African-American and Latino.
A lot of them are, sure.
If you look at the people who are on the conservative side of the Democratic Party, most of them are people of color. And we know that we have various issues with the black left and the black right, and that black folks are not a cohesive group of people.
Right.
But the one thing that we can say conclusively about, black conservatives who vote Democrat is that because of their history of discrimination, they are not cool with legal discrimination.
Yeah.
They understand even more than our allies who are, liberal white folks that, okay, when we're talking about official government action, you really need the government to leave people alone and let them live their lives. If it becomes an issue of official governmental discrimination, then the black Christian churches that everybody blamed for things not going well in California are actually on our side.
Yes.
And are more likely to be our allies.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is recognize that who the coalition actually includes when it comes to black and Latino conservatives who are on our side as Democrats, they're also our allies as LGBT folks. They may not like us. They may not agree with us on a religious aspect. They may believe some very problematic things. But when it comes to a official discrimination by the government, they are more likely to back us than not.
Right.
Unfortunately, I don't think that the party itself at the top levels thinks that nuanced and just thinks, well, we don't want to try to alienate these people, so maybe we shouldn't go too far with the LGBT support. That's my guess.
Yeah. I mean, and the whole thing with Prop 8 and blaming the black churches and then having it come out that really, the money was poured in from Mormon institutions, essentially, that they pretty much funded Prop 8. You're absolutely right, Will. Black conservatives, there have been anecdotal evidence that I know in my own life may discriminate against their own kids or may believe problematic things personally. But when it comes to what you were saying, government discrimination, legalized discrimination, they're not for it, but not ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the personal level stuff is stuff we do need to deal with culturally.
Yes.
But it's a very different thing from official government discrimination. And yeah. I've never experienced that kind of direct homophobia. I don't support your right to exist from even conservative black folks that I've talked to.
Nope, me either.
Like I've never experienced that kind of hatred from black folks who are conservative. I have from white folks.
Yep.
And I've seen it in their voting patterns.
Yes.
And the numbers back us up on this. So yep. I think that's what we need to do is to stop. Well, and also when you talk about the Democratic leadership, we all agree that it needs to get nuked, basically. Yep. Debbie Wasserman Schultz has to go. Everybody left, right, up and down in the Democratic Party knows it. We need new leadership there. Like, I almost want to say we need the DNC to be run by Elizabeth Warren. That's
right.
That's
the everything next. To be run by Elizabeth Warren. Somebody floated her the other day for Supreme Court justice. Someone floated her for head of the DNC. Someone wants her to be the vice president. I mean, we just need a lot more Elizabeth Warrens. But I'd like to see a person of color heading the DNC.
Oh, yeah. I would love to see someone who, you know, understands the issues in the South, too. I would love to see someone who's probably Georgian. Let's get somebody from Georgia, which is that next big Republican state we need to win. Someone from Texas, somebody who's a person of color who understands what's going on. Unfortunately, we had somebody from Texas on the congressional, I think the DCCC, and his perspective was, well, the Republicans are going to be so horrible that we don't actually have to do anything.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that, which is stupid.
Yeah, we need to find the right person. And I think someone who's a person of color, maybe somebody from the South who understands how to win there, might be a good idea. But
well, I really like the Castro brothers down in Texas. You know, yeah. I lived down in San Antonio when they sort of rose to prominence. And I am hoping/betting that if Hillary is the eventual nominee, one of them is going to be her VP pick, which I think would be fantastic.
I also really like Cory Booker from New Jersey.
Cory Booker, he's another name that I could see for a big leadership position within the party.
Yep.
I think that
I'm laughing because I remember people attacking Cory Booker very recently. Apparently he feels the purity test because he worked with bankers, because of course he did. He was
People will get over that after this primary season. I mean, you know how it is in the primary season. There's all the purity tests on every side, and that dies away as people get a little more realistic and the emotions simmer down a little bit. But, you know, even Bernie is failing purity tests here and there. It's when you talk about his gun stuff and – yeah, nobody can be too pure, ideologically pure, on either side of the aisle. We know that. Nope. So you just move on from there. But anyway, we've been gabbing for an hour. Just some closing thoughts here, guys. Will?
You know, as we've talked about this, I want to reiterate two main points for what we ought to do as LGBT folks. Number one, bisexuals, come out. Let your voices be known. We are the largest group of people. If we work together, we can really solve the problems within our community. Stop being afraid that you don't exist.
Yeah.
And stop accepting the erasure that society has provided you with, whether it's someone who is comfortably straight or someone who doesn't correct folks that they're not actually gay. Like, be bisexual.
Yes.
Come out and be who you are. Number two, as we do that, we need to remember trans folks, we need to remember the other erased people within the community, and we as this big force need to start backing them and helping elevate them into positions where they can help us do things, because nobody is going to understand what the black LGBTQ community needs more than people who are black and who come from that area. Nobody's going to understand what trans folk need better than trans folk. So we need to make sure that as we make the LGBT community less LG, we need to also be making sure that it's not that B doesn't become this massive force that erases other folks. We need to be anti-erasure because of the way that erasure is used against us. And my final point is, talk about us, politicians. Earn our votes. And the thing is, if you talk about us in areas where there is a plurality that supports us, you can make some big wins. You can make your wins even bigger. We are now the wedge issue where the Republicans will probably force the issue and bring in some kind of referenda or something. And that will be a vote winner for us.
Yes.
This is something we can do. Talking about our issues and what affects us is a winning strategy. And final point, once again, as we're talking about healthcare, if someone who is transgender does not have HRT covered by their insurance plan, then they might as well not have health insurance, because the greatest existential threat to their life is not covered.
Yeah. Rach?
100%. I'm just going to piggyback off of that. I agree with everything you just said. And to your point of, first of all, come out, please. And second of all, we need to, this goes to everybody in the LGBT community and really community at large. When we start to bring these people in and stop this erasure, I'd like to see us put people, you know, to your point, you know, someone black from the LGBT community or someone trans in positions of power and leadership within our community. Mm-hmm. Not just, hey, these people exist, let's see what we can do for them, but put them in positions of leadership, put them in positions of visibility so that the rest of the country looks at us and doesn't think that we're all, you know, Jesse Ferguson from Modern Family or something, that we are a large, yeah, diverse community with lots of diverse needs, and putting people at the forefront of our movement and of our community in a place of visibility, I think, will help contribute to that.
I agree.
Great, guys. Great discussion today. Will, you have basically an open invitation. Anytime you want to come chat with us about anything, yes, you are more than welcome to hop on board here.
I will take you up on that, because this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. So we got a lot of exciting stuff coming up. We are going to try to live stream Tuesday for Super Super Tuesday. And Will, if you want to get in on that, we can talk off the air maybe, if you're available.
Interested.
Okay, cool. So we'll talk about that. We have the great Greg Dworkin from Daily Coast to wag his finger at us Bernie supporters on Friday. we're really looking forward to that. And we have some other folks from a bunch of different podcasts want to have us on. I got to sort through those. I'll talk to Rachel off the air about that before I make any announcements. Still trying to get some other guests, including some local politicians here running against the unctuous Joanne Wynholtz. I just talked today to one of our campaign guys in terms of the Wynholtz thing. Yes, it's still happening. Yes, we're going to have our big, huge, mega monster rally. We're just getting everything lined up for that. So stay tuned for more news about that. Our good friend and correspondent Molly is going to be going to the county delegate convention. Is it Saturday, Rachel?
It's Saturday, yep.
So maybe probably later in the day, if we can, we'll talk to her about how that all went.
Yes.
Just all kinds of exciting stuff and things and coming up.
Listen to Hopping Mad. It's one of my favorite podcasts. Will is the co-host with Arliss Bunny. They cover a lot of really in-depth stuff. Arliss is sort of a economics
guru,
yeah,
savant, whatever you want to call it.
Mad. Will, do you want to give the contact info for that podcast?
Yeah, you can find us at imhoppingmad.com. That's imhoppingmad.com. And we're on iTunes, and you can find us on Twitter as well.
And when does Netroots simulcaster stream, you guys?
We stream at 8 a.m. on Monday morning Eastern Standard Time.
Cool. One day we might be down there too if Wink and Justice are able to find my email. So
I hope so.
We're getting there. So yeah, thanks a lot, Will. Obviously, thanks a lot, Rachel. This has been Irreverent Testimony. As usual, stay active, stay tuned, stay involved, and adios. Bottles on deck and goddammit, I'm feeling myself. Cause I'ma get it all and I'ma throw it out like goddammit, I'm feeling myself. Look up in the mirror look at me. The mirror be like, baby, you the shit. Goddammit, you the shit, you the shit, you the shit. Goddammit, you the shit, goddammit, you the shit, you the shit. What's up? I be everywhere, everybody know me. Catch me in the club, 100 bottles on me. I get busy like a one line. And drop your head, baby, never mind. We getting money while you playing with it. Pool in the crib, you can land a water plane in it. Slick Rick looking at the mirror. Big Daddy came, bitch, like Shakira. 1.5 custom made cop. Me and Will table looking like the bop. Love, bad, that's my problem. Now I don't give a fuck, that's my pride. And I don't give a fuck, that's my whole MO. Yeah. I rock the whole globe with no problemo. Yeah. Been rocking coast, my first demo. Yeah. And now I'm banging hoes in the Continental. Yep. And now they see me sliding on my dope ride. Yep. I open up the doors, suicide. Yep. I came from the bottom, the suicide. Yep. I made it to the top cause I do it fly. Yep. Feeling fucking lucky like the fucking Irish. I see the whole game from my third iris. I tour the whole world like a dirty pirate. Then give my whole club some Miley Cyrus. Now everybody tripping like they pop a Miley. Hey. Up in the club is where you find me. Hey. I do it real big, never do it tiny. If you
you about the bullshit.